Welcome back to In the Moment. Dr. Jeff Levermore has researched and written extensively about the impacts of climate change. He was a member of the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change that received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. He is in South Dakota today for a visit to Augustana College, where he'll speak on climate change and the urban heat island. That's at 7 p.m. Central in the Froyland Science Complex. He is sitting down at the studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Dr. Levermore, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you very much, Laurie.
Now, out of the thousands of ways to focus, going back to 2007 and that intergovernmental panel, your focus was on buildings. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, it was on buildings because buildings are responsible for about 30% of greenhouse gas emissions in the world. And the greatest potential for saving greenhouse gas emissions is actually in buildings and the electricity they use as well. There has also been another IPCC report that was in 2013, so it has been updated.
What were the updates from 2007 to 2013? What really stands out?
Well, really confirming that what we're actually doing in the planet is making a difference, and confirming the climate change models that what is happening is due to us. And we've got extra confirmation of that. I think one of the very interesting things that I've learned recently is that if you look at the ice cores on the Antarctic, here the snow builds up and it forms ice, which goes back to about 800,000 years. Now, the interesting thing is, in these slices of the ice core, you've got little bubbles of air, and you can analyse the carbon dioxide there. And the brilliant thing is that you can actually tell the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere back to 800,000 years ago and up to the present day, which is due to our fossil fuel burning as opposed to natural carbon. So now we have a measure of exactly how much mankind is putting into the atmosphere. And if you look at that graph, it starts to change about the year 1750. Now, the year 1750 was when the Industrial Revolution started in Britain. And it then slowly starts to increase rapidly. And we're now considering that we've got a geological era, which is the Anthropocene, which is where mankind's influence on the planet can actually be measured.
Has there been progress at all, or has it is just a straight increase in that impact, and it's all negative? Or are we starting to see some of the choices that we're making reverse the trend?
Well, I think the really interesting thing, there are two things. Great things have been happening in the US because you've been using gas instead of coal, and your actual carbon emissions from electricity production have reduced by about 30%. So the US is doing great things, and we're leading the way. The second great thing is that there was the agreement in Paris. The United Nations get the IPCC together. The IPCC just gives advice to politicians as to what the science actually is. It doesn't have its own opinions. It just says what scientists have found. And they then decide what they can actually do. And the politicians and their advisors have meetings. And there was one in Paris. And the conclusions of the last IPCC meeting about climate change and man's contribution was signed up to by 196 nations. And this is really great because it shows that it's a world problem. And we need an organization like the United Nations to actually help promote these things. And the other thing is that China came on board and India came on board, that everybody's signed up to it, including the US. And some of my colleagues in the US on climate change are doing really great work. And I hope that the leadership of the US in the world on climate change will continue.
Can you explain to me what an urban heat island is in a way that sort of makes sense to the layperson?
The urban heat island is actually the fact that in the centre of a city, on a cool night, it will be warmer in the city centre than it will be in a rural area. And this is primarily because the heat cannot escape, because you've got all the buildings stopping it getting out to the cold sky at night. So it means that the areas in the city centre get warmer. Now, you then add this onto the climate change, and it means that people that are living in the city centres won't be able to sleep so well. It'll be, you know, 6-7 degrees hotter at night than it would be if they're on a farm, say 20 kilometres, 20 miles out of the city centre. And therefore, you're going to need more air conditioning, and you're probably going to get more heat-related deaths in the summer due to the urban heat island.
How big does a city have to be when we look at things in South Dakota? Are any of those cities large enough to have a measurable impact, or do you have to get much larger?
Well, it is the big cities like Manhattan, New York, London, Chicago, and so forth. That I should imagine Sioux Falls does have an urban heat island, because the other thing is that it's where you've got concrete as opposed to grass and trees. It would be very interesting to measure it. But I should imagine that, you know, little places like Manchester in England, which we've been looking at, has an urban heat island of about 8 degrees at its worst. I mean, this doesn't happen every night. It's just when you've got cold, clear skies that the heat cannot escape so easily from a city as it can from elsewhere. You've also got to be realistic that it also means that during the winter, the urban areas are going to be actually warmer, so you won't have to use so much heating. So you can't just say it's all negative. There are positives as well. And you often see birds fly into a city centre in the winter because it's warmer than it is in the outskirts.
How big is Manchester, for a perspective?
Manchester? Oh, I suppose it's got a radius of about Greater Manchester, about 13 miles. And it's about the third biggest city in England.
So how important are the buildings themselves, and how important are the way that we use the buildings, or that people use the buildings? Where's the greatest impact, and how do they compare?
Well, I think the thing is that buildings can be such that we don't have to use much energy at all. I mean, if you have solar panels and you can actually generate your own electricity, we are talking about having a net zero energy building, which means that during the summer you can generate electricity and you use more during the winter. It depends whether you're in a hot climate where you need air conditioning, or you're in a cold climate, which most of the UK is, where you don't need air conditioning. But you can actually have buildings where you don't need to use much energy at all, plenty of insulation and solar shading, that this is where you can actually reduce your use of electricity and gas and oil, so that you can reduce gas emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. So it is all there. It's technology that's available. And the other positive thing is that in Britain, we've got a lot of old buildings. But in the States, I was looking today, and you've got relatively new buildings. And you simply put up new buildings. And so you have the opportunity of building passive energy buildings, zero energy buildings, quite easily. Okay, it's going to cost more money, but we've got to think that what we are doing today is putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and affecting things for 100 years. This means that it's going to be our grandchildren's grandchildren that will be affected. And we've got to think how we can make the planet better for them, and that they don't look back and blame us for having a great time burning and guzzling energy without any consideration for them.
Are there economic impacts in the future, long term, as well? Or is it mostly a philosophical, we need to do the right thing, or, you know, is a local economy at stake?
Certainly. It is the major crisis that is affecting mankind at present. And it is going to cost mankind. Now, Lord Stern did a report, and he said that there's going to be opportunities for new industries. People selling solar panels, wind turbines, selling more efficient buildings, more efficient air conditioning, better lighting, LEDs instead of tungsten and fluorescent, things like this. So there are great opportunities. But we've got to stop using so much fossil fuels. And we've got to effectively say that fossil fuels we use are going to be more expensive to pay for renewables. There's no two ways about it. It's not going to be cheap, but it's going to reduce pollution as well. And the interesting thing is that China, which is producing a lot of electricity, a lot of coal-burning stations, is also installing most of the solar panels in the world at the moment because they realise that pollution is a major problem for them. And in certain days in Shanghai and Beijing, you are not allowed to drive your car. People look at their apps at the pollution level and say the pollution is so bad the children cannot go to school today. And this is the effect. So this is why China's signed up and India's signed up, because with global warming, you've also got the pollution due to the generation of electricity, and it's becoming a major problem.
Let's talk about developing countries, many of whose citizens don't have electricity at all, but who certainly want it and want to live a lifestyle similar to what you might see in America. What's the message for them as they try to start developing further and having some of those conveniences and health benefits of air conditioning, for example?
Well, I think the thing is that one of my research students is now an MP in Burkina Faso. It's one of the poorest countries in Africa, but they have a lot of solar power available if they can get solar panels. And he was going to be responsible for 100 megawatt installation in the Sahel. I mean, if we cover the Sahara region with solar panels, we covered quite a bit of the areas in the US which are unproductive with solar panels, we'd end up having a lot of electricity which could be used. And the thing is that what we can do in African countries, if they have solar panels and they have batteries and light emitting diodes, LED lighting, it means that children in rural areas can do their schoolwork at night, when previously they would actually have to have had candles or fires and or not been able to do the work. Also the fact that a lot of the world do not have access to electricity and they have to have fires for cooking, and there's a lot of mortality for women because they're cooking and there are the emissions of these fires as they burn fuel that they can get hold of. And also a lot of infant deaths. So it's a win-win situation. But what does it mean? It means that they've got to have subsidies from the West. Now, people would say, well, why should we bother to pay them? Well, the thing is that you'll get instabilities. And you could have a third world war breaking out over fresh water. So the fact is, it's always going to be the poor that suffer. But the thing is, you can get riots, you can get wars breaking out because there are these injustices, and crops fail. There's migration of large-scale numbers of people. There's a problem in Africa at the moment with the fact that there's a famine, and this is going to get worse. And when you get these situations, the world becomes more unstable politically. So climate change really goes right through to the politics and the stability of the world.
Where are you seeing the most exciting or hopeful or forward-thinking research on this topic as far as solutions are concerned? Where is that coming out of, and what are you excited about?
Well, what excites me is that life is all about challenges, and mankind has an inquiring mind. And all generations have their own problems. My parents were alive during the Second World War, faced death. I've never had to face that. But each generation has its own problems. And these are challenges, especially for academics who can do research. And in my work on the IPCC, I had the great pleasure and privilege of working with people from Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in California. And they're doing some great work there. And there's some great work being done in the States because there's so much wealth in the States and so much is being done. And some of the states are very good on climate change, and some states are trying to become almost zero energy or sustainable, and this is a positive. There's work being done in Europe as well, and I think that, for instance, light-emitting diodes, that is much more efficient. It's almost 10 times more efficient than an ordinary tungsten lamp. And we have technology, and with buildings which are responsible for a third of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, we've got things that we can do there. So, but the really exciting thing to my mind was the fact that we got everybody to sign up to the Paris Agreement. Now, okay, the governments have got to go back and sell it. We've got to see their plans. And I think the challenge now is to get it over to Joe Public as to why they should be voting for politicians that want to carry these things forward so we can save the planet for our great-great-grandkids.
What do you think one of the biggest obstacles is to that? Is it a simple fear of change or an understanding that these things are expensive and difficult to pay for? How is it going to affect my pocketbook right now? What do you think the biggest obstacles are for the public to sort of accept the science and support the solutions?
Well, I think you've pinpointed it. Will the public actually vote for things that are going to cost them money? And I think that most people could not really deny the climate science. It is just stacking up. We've known for 150 years that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, and it's acting like an insulating blanket on the world. There's no discussion over that. It's a well-known fact. And looking at the carbon-12 and carbon-13 isotopes, we can see how much we are putting into the atmosphere. But it's this political issue, and I think we are all, and to a certain extent, I mean, I'm a bit of a hypocrite because I've been flying quite a lot recently, and we've got to accept that we've got to vote for people that are going to actually put the price of electricity, price of gas up, and it's not going to be so cheap to fly. I mean, some flights that I've seen in the UK, you know, for about $10, you can fly all the way to Poland. Absolutely crazy. That do we need to travel quite so much, or should we not pay more tax, a carbon tax? And it's really, people will not vote for things that are going to affect them. Unless it can be got over to them, it's going to affect their children's children's children. And this pollution is increasing. And we're seeing more effects that there's going to be the oceans of the world are going to rise. A lot of major cities are built on rivers and near the sea. I mean, Manhattan, if you get a rise in the sea level and that gets flooded, it's going to have major economic impacts. If you're affected by squalls or the weather, an intense downpour, and people are killed, I think it gradually seeps into people. But I think we'd love to ignore it and hope it goes away and we can enjoy a nice cheap lifestyle. So it's an ethical, almost religious thing that we must love our neighbour as ourselves. And our neighbour actually is our unborn child's child. And we've got to look forward for that. Because if we don't, and we get beyond a tipping point, however wealthy we are, and we're all getting wealthier as the world goes on, we might be able to do nothing to stop the climate change increase. It could just gallop off, and there's very little we could do engineering-wise. But now we have the opportunity, if we spend a bit more money, that it will save a lot later on.
How close are we to the tipping point?
Halfway. The IPCC say if we have a rise of 2 degrees compared to the average temperature, over the last 50 years. And the problem was we got to 1 degree, where over 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide. Now, typically, this was almost half of that throughout the rest of history. And again, this was down to measurements that were done at Mauna Loa by Keeling, an American, that showed that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is increasing. And I think that we have to do something to try and arrest that. And in the States, you've been doing that. As I say, the 30% reduction in your carbon emissions due to electricity, and that's because you're using gas more than coal, the fracking, and also that it means that we'll probably have to use more nuclear power as well. The answers are there. We've got to have the potential will, because we've got enough fossil fuels. There's an estimate from BP that in the year 2050, we will have three times the amount of fossil fuels we actually need to use. But the thing is that we've got to leave most of those fossil fuels in the ground. And this has major, major economic repercussions, because my pension, a lot of that's in oil and gas companies and energy companies. And sorry, I'm going on rather.
So when you talk about the generation, every generation has its own problems. You mentioned your parents in World War II. You're really talking about a new generation making a sacrifice like the greatest generation did.
Yes. Oh. That's what it comes down to. It's an ethical, almost religious thing that we've got to actually put people's welfare and future ahead of a short-term gain that we can make. So we make a few bucks and it doesn't cost us quite as much. We can still do the things we want to do in inefficient cars, in inefficient buildings. We should spend that money so that we're looking to the future.
Dr. Jeff Levermore, you can see him tonight speaking on climate change and the urban climate change and the urban heat island. That's at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, 7 p.m. Central in the Froyland Science Complex. And he was a member of the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change that received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Much more to talk about there, Dr. Levermore. Thank you so much and enjoy your stay in South Dakota.
Thank you very much, Laurie. Thank you.